Good morning. Welcome to the press briefing of the Information Service of the UN in Geneva. Welcome to this press briefing. Let's start immediately by listening to Jonathan Fowler. You know, Jonathan has been with UNRWA for quite a while now, and he is now replacing Juliet, that we will hear a little bit later. So, Jonathan, welcome to the briefing. You have an update on your operations and on the event at the East Jerusalem UNRWA compound, the recent event. So I'll give you the floor. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you very much indeed, Alessandra. Good to see everybody. So I want to underscore again what's happened this week at the UNRWA compound in East Jerusalem. And I also want to emphasize this is a United Nations compound like any other. What we saw is what UNRWA Commissioner General Philip Lazzarini called a new level of open and deliberate defiance of international law. This is a site which is covered by the privileges and immunities of the United Nations. And the storming and demolition of the compound by Israeli authorities is appalling. It's an outrage, and it has potential impacts well beyond UNRWA, well beyond the United Nations, and potentially globally, because these kind of breaches of international law, this is absolutely unprecedented, storming into a United Nations compound, destroying it, expropriating it. As recently as October last year, the International Court of Justice stressed that Israel is obliged to facilitate, not hinder or prevent UNRWA's operations. So what we saw this week, I mean, flies in the face of that ruling from the International Court of Justice. We've seen a lot in the media including statements also by Israeli officials claiming that they own the land that the facility was situated on. These assertions need to be dismissed and dismissed outright. Contrary to these assertions, the Israeli government does not own or have rights to the land. The International Court of Justice and the United Nations General Assembly have both repeatedly emphasized that the occupation of East Jerusalem is illegal, and therefore Israel has no sovereign rights over the land. Philip Lazzarini also talked about a lost moral compass. And the reason for this is that multiple Israeli officials were on site during the demolition, filming and posting content on social media celebrating it, and making statements alike the fact that UNRWA staff need to be annihilated. I mean, really, really, this is incredibly worrying. This opens the road for more actions. We're very fearful that the next step could be the seizure of our training center, our vocational training center in East Jerusalem, and that would deprive hundreds of students of their right to education. So that's all I have on the compound. But I just want to emphasize very, very quickly, it's 1 year since the Israeli forces launched their Operation Iron Wall in the north of the West Bank. Now, this led to the mass displacement of people from three camps in the north of the West Bank. UNRWA continues to be the largest provider of humanitarian aid to around 33,000 people who've been displaced for the last 12 months. These Palestine refugees who were expelled by the Israeli forces from the camps, they're living in poverty, they've had their income cut off, they have very few prospects of returning to their homes. The camps are progressively being demolished by the Israeli military, so therefore changing the facts on the ground, changing the topography and the demography of these large communities. We're providing healthcare, we're providing cash for rent, and we're also providing schooling for 4,600 children who were expelled from these camps. And then finally, on schooling, given that it's International Day for Education tomorrow, I also want to emphasize what we're doing on education in Gaza. We have 65,000 children in what we call temporary learning spaces. These are children receiving direct education from UNRWA teachers on the ground. We're also providing digital learning to almost 300,000 children in Gaza. But the key thing is these children need to be able to get back into proper schooling as soon as possible, because there's a huge risk of a lost generation. These children have been out of school for much too long, and they have to be able to get back to school, proper school, as soon as possible. That's all from me. Thank you.
Thank you very much, for, Jonathan. That's really a welcome update. I'd like now to give the floor to Juliette Touma, who has joined us. Juliette, I'd like to see if you can... Let's see if we can see you.
Can you see me? Hi, good morning.
Yes, we can. Hello, Juliette. Hi.
How are you?
Juliette, our journalists are accustomed to see you speaking to them for UNRWA, which Jonathan just said. So maybe you want to say one word about your new role, but also tell us about your executive director, the executive director of UNOPS, who visited recently Gaza. You have the floor. And then we will open for questions.
Thank you, Alessandra. Good to be back in this forum. And hi, everyone. Hi, Jonathan, as well. And thank you for the very compelling briefing. I mean, it's just unbelievable to see what was happening, and quite shocking. So best regards to you and the team, and thank you for the update. Everyone, I wanted to say hello really informally, and to say that I have moved now from UNRWA to UNOPS and the Office of Project Services. Based out of Copenhagen. It's freezing this morning. I wanted to tell you a little bit about this new role and to reintroduce myself and to also share credentials and contacts and that. And yes, like Alessandra said, to speak a little bit about the Gaza visit, and to say that the executive director of UNOPS is available for interviews about his Gaza visit. So, Alessandra, I'll put in the chat box my new contacts, and if you can share that with the team, it would be great. And then I'll try to come every now and again to Geneva, so that I can meet you and the team and members of the press in person. I'm hoping to do that maybe early March. On the visit of the executive director to Gaza happened a few days ago, and really the focus was to go and see the team on the ground working in Gaza. It was just around the 100 days since the ceasefire was announced in Gaza. A ceasefire that brought some respite to the civilians, to the families in Gaza, but unfortunately people continue to be killed day in, day out in Gaza. When it comes to the work that UNOPS does in Gaza, you probably know that it's largely around the delivery of fuel. Every day UNOPS teams bring in fuel, which is absolutely critical to services, including those that UNRWA continues to provide to Palestinians in Gaza, but also to bakeries, to clinics, to whatever is still standing in terms of hospitals, to water facility, and to electricity grid. So that's really a big chunk of the work that UNOPS does there. It was also the week of the very heavy storm that the people of Gaza have endured, a regional storm. We were able to witness firsthand the impact of the lack of basic material that will help families cope with winter. That is something that UNOPS and several other UN agencies continue to struggle in, bringing at scale much needed humanitarian supplies every day. Before going to Gaza, we were in Jordan, where there is the really important, what is called Jordan Corridor. That's the direct line of aid delivery from Jordan to Gaza. that has not been working or functional for the past 4 months since the incident on King Hussein or Allenby Bridge in mid-September. And the executive director called for reopening that direct line, meaning the direct delivery of much needed supplies from Jordan, supplies that the United Nations has bought, including UNOPS, supplies that are currently stuck in UNOPS-built warehouses in Jordan. There's around 10 of them in the capital that are full of basic supplies, including those to help people with winter, which is ongoing. The executive director has also announced or welcomed the announcement of the second phase, which happened when he was on the ground in the region. And he called finally for several actions that must be taken immediately. That first and foremost is around the improvement of humanitarian access, the opening of all crossings, including that Jordan corridor, which I just told you about, and an increase in the flow of basic supplies, and less restrictions on bringing those supplies, including the so-called dual use, which we've spoken to several times in this forum. In the end, the executive director of UNOPS acknowledged the huge suffering, the unspeakable suffering of the people of Gaza. He said no one should experience such suffering, and he called on the international community to remain engaged and act with urgency beyond the immediate response to the humanitarian crisis, and called for a long-lasting political and diplomatic solution to the conflict between the Palestinians and the Israelis. That's what I have, Alessandra.
Thank you
for having me to take any questions.
Yes, thank you very much. And just before opening the floor to questions, I'd just like to recall the statement that we have distributed to you about the demolition of the UNRWA Sheikh Jarrah compound by the Secretary General that sent you a couple of days ago. So let me open the floor to questions now. First in the room, Nina Larsson, AFP.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the briefing. So nice to see you both. I had a few questions. I was wondering on the first on the UNRWA compound. Obviously, there's been a lot of outrage about it, but that doesn't seem to have slowed down this operation. Is there anything that the international community can do that could reverse this, or what should be happening right now to reverse the situation? And then I also had a question on the, the peace board thoughts around the future of Gaza, if you have any thoughts on what's been coming out of on that. And finally, I had a question on the journalists who were killed in Gaza. It's been, I think, 220 journalists. I mean, what does it say about the impunity that's being permitted right now? And is there anything the UN or the international community can do about this? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nina. I'll let our colleague answer just on the issue of the Board of Peace. What we can say that we are very strongly committed to do whatever we can to ensure the full implementation of the Security Council Resolution 2803, which, as you recall, welcomed the creation of the Board for Gaza. And as you see, there is a role for the UN there about the UN leading on humanitarian aid delivery, which we have been doing for such a long time. We will continue to do the best of our capacities. Jonathan, you want to start on the UNRWA compound, and then maybe Juliette, if you want to chime in.
Yeah, thanks very much indeed for the question, Nina. Look, I mean, there was an outpouring of international condemnation for what happened at the compound. We would hope that that would focus minds in the various levels of the Israeli authorities, so municipality through to national government. Sadly, we've seen a pattern of disregard for international humanitarian law over and over. And, you know, UNRWA has been on the sharp end of this. I mean, we're immensely grateful for the statements from governments, senior officials around the world condemning this. But the action has to come from the Israeli authorities to cease these kind of things. This, in many ways, is much, much bigger than UNRWA. As I emphasized in my introductory remarks, this is a United Nations compound. So this is an attack on the United Nations. It's an attack on international law, and it's something with potential implications globally, because what happens to UNRWA now could happen to another agency tomorrow in the occupied Palestinian territory or elsewhere. So, you know, this creates this kind of precedent, and this is extremely dangerous. So we need more condemnation, but we need action. Action has to come at various levels to stop this kind of thing. In the meantime, of course, we continue doing our work. I mean, we're unbowed. We have not stopped, and we will not stop doing what we are committed to do and what is our mission given to us by the United Nations General Assembly. Most recently, our mandate was renewed in December, and we continue doing what we do. I should add also that we need to have the means to do to fulfill our mission to provide public-like services for Palestine refugees, primarily education and healthcare. We do not have the financial resources which are adequate to do our work to the full at a time when we are under immense pressure and where demands and needs are rising, not just because of the humanitarian disaster in Gaza, but also the situation in the West Bank. But indeed, the complexity of operating in Jordan, Lebanon and Syria as well. So we need the financial means to do that. Over.
Yes, indeed. Sorry. And just to recall that the Secretary General has made a very, very, very urgent request to the government of Israel to return and restore the compound. And he has written a very direct letter to the government of Israel about this. Juliet, maybe you want to say something, add something to,
yes,
to this?
And perhaps, yes, thanks, Alessandra. And hi, Nina. Perhaps just on to what needs to happen now in Gaza. Absolutely fundamental that the ceasefire holds. It's that phase, Nina, right now between just after a ceasefire and just before massive reconstruction. So it's that day in between, which means it's about the basics and restoring basic services. Which is why, for example, bringing fuel to Gaza every single day is absolutely critical, and that must continue at scale and every day without any interruption, and there should be, in fact, an increase. So it's the restoration of basic services that includes primary healthcare, including services that UNRWA provides, but also water pumps and water stations, electricity. The electricity grid in Gaza is severely damaged because of the war. And perhaps you've heard the UNOPS executive director say that all is needed is $10 million for that a grid to be rebuilt and for people to have much more electricity than they have today. So it's those things that must happen now while there are all these agreements on the shape and the form of reconstruction. The people of Gaza cannot wait. They need supplies at the same time. It's not just the services. This is why it's absolutely critical to unlock these the congestion, if you wish, at crossing points, to reopen critical lifelines like the Jordan corridor. So it's urgent action that is needed now.
Olivia?
Good morning. Thank you very much, both of you, for the briefing. A few questions from me, if I may. First of all, from Unwad's perspective, if I could just get some more details about the training centre, which you're worried could be the next to be seized, perhaps you could just detail what it does exactly and how many students it supports. And if, in the meantime, following this week and also that concern there, if any other provisional plans are being made. You also mentioned that you don't have the financial means in order to sufficiently help everybody. Perhaps you could just give some detail on what that means materially. If I may also just ask about Lazzarini, I understand he is due to be finishing his tenure soon. Any news on his replacement and when that might be announced? And sorry, another one from UNRWA, please, as well. There was mention there about the UN having a leading role in humanitarian aid supply, but what role, if any, will UNRWA have under the Gaza Board of Peace and the Phase 2 plan? And a question to both of you, but also I think Tariq from the World Health Organization is on the call, just about Rafah. There's talk of it, the crossing opening next week, in both directions. Do you have any more detail on that? And also how much of a game changer might that be if that does happen? Thank you.
Thanks very much. So forgive me if I missed any of those, but in jumbled up order to respond. So yes, regarding the Commissioner General's mandate, indeed his term ends is scheduled to end in March. No more details on that at this stage. Regarding the Board of Peace, nothing specifically, but I do want to emphasize we are the largest United Nations agency operating in the Gaza Strip. We have the knowledge, we have the trust of the community, and we have the mandate from the United Nations General Assembly, and we must remain and we must be able to continue doing our work. That's crystal clear. We have to be part of the reconstruction. By definition, I mean, that's what we're mandated to do. Forgive me, I need you to repeat the other two questions.
One was about the financial issue.
Yes. Okay, so on the finances, just to give you a picture of what we need, our role is very specific. We have a unique mandate in the United Nations, which is that we are a direct provider of public-like services. So we don't do capacity build. I mean, we do capacity building, but we also have around 30,000 staff who provide public-like services, essentially education and healthcare. So, you know, our funding model, though, is it's voluntary contributions from countries. That, in a sense, you know, if you imagined a civil service in a country that it doesn't have a tax base or clear funding flows, that could potentially be a problem. Now, in our case, we need around $880 million a year to do our work. That work is incredible value for money, in fact, because when you look at the health and education outcomes of Palestine refugees, you know, we deliver. There's the United Nations. We do our job, and we support those outcomes. You know, the indicators are all very good, despite the complexity of the situation. $880 million to do that. But last year, from donors, so primarily governments, we received around $570 million. So you can do the mathematics on this. That's just not enough to do our work. Now, we had to enact austerity measures already last year in a situation where, as I said, demand is incredibly high. And we've had to do more. You know, we've had to most recently announce that we would be reducing our service delivery week by about 20%. So that has an immediate impact. You know, when that comes in, that's scheduled to come in February. That means less healthcare, less education for Palestine refugees, despite the fact that we are mandated to do these things. So that really needs to focus minds. You know, we need the financial support. We need the financial tools to be able to do our job. And then there was the first question again, if Alessandra, if you could remind me. Oh, the training centre. Sorry. Yes.
Kalandia Training Centre.
Yeah. I'm sorry. So look, the Kalandia Training Centre We have 350 students, aged 15 to 19, male students, every year. And these students are learning a trade, basically. That could be, you know, automotive engineering, vehicle maintenance, you know, maintaining agricultural machinery, plumbing, electricity, heating engineering, these kind of things. Generally, I mean, these students come from across the West Bank. It's a residential centre, obviously incredibly complex if they were having to move every day to come to the college. It's on land which is situated, it's kind of straddles the boundary between occupied East Jerusalem and Area C of the West Bank, so that's already, you know, geographically complicated. Israeli officials have repeatedly slated it for expropriation so that they can construct settlements there. That's the stated plan. We've had incursions by Israeli forces, tear gassing, all kinds of things. The point is that these students, this is a unique training center. These students generally come from non-academic backgrounds, lower income families. So this is a social justice issue. If the center were to be forcibly closed, and we do fear that this could happen within days, there is no educational alternative for these students. So you're depriving a large cohort of Palestine refugees of economic opportunities and, you know, life opportunities, basically. And so the right to education would be under attack there. And as I said, I mean, this is about social justice. This is an incredibly important issue. And this cannot be allowed to happen. Now, we had a visit by diplomats from donor governments that happened last week. It's on the same day that the compound in East Jerusalem was stormed and demolished. And Israeli forces were outside the compound while the diplomats were in, and they were firing tear gas. Now, clearly, this is a sign of intent. And really, the international community needs to wake up and has to make clear that Calandia Training Center must be able to continue operating. I mean, the mission of that center is incredibly important, and it has to continue.
Thank you very much. Juliet, do you want to add anything?
Yes, I think Olivia's question on Rafah and... You know, whether we have more information or not, I don't think we do. We've seen the reports about it in the media, and look, like I said earlier, any additional opening in those crossings are literally life-saving for the people of Gaza. And so all crossings to and out of Gaza must reopen as soon as possible. There should be an increase in the flow of humanitarian and other basic supplies so that people can get improved access to basic services and cope with the inhumane living conditions that they're going through right now.
Thank you very much. Do you mind? I'll go to the colleagues. Okay, go ahead then. If we missed one.
Sorry. Yeah, no, it was just the question about the journalists who were killed, which I don't think I got a response to. And I know that the human rights people don't seem to be online today, but it would be good to have a UN response to the fact that there were three journalists, including one who worked very frequently for us, for AFP, who was killed, and when there's supposed to be a ceasefire. So if there's any reaction from the UN, that would be good. Thank you.
I think, we don't have our colleagues of OHCHR this morning, but because also, as you know, there is a session very close to here, a special session on Iran. But I think we can just say that, the position of the UN, it's always been the same. We need journalists to be able to do their work. We need freedom of the press. We need to have journalists who can ask questions, do their work, and their work be respected. We need to protect journalists. I don't have a specific comment on this particular case. I don't know if my colleagues do, but I think the UN position on freedom of the press is unchanged, and we need to be able to ensure and protect freedom of the press. Jonathan, I see your hand, and then Juliette, I see your hand.
Yeah, thank you. I can address this in part. I mean, you know, the Gaza Strip is the most dangerous place in the world to be a journalist. It's also the most dangerous place in the world to be a humanitarian. UNRWA has had almost 400 of our colleagues killed in the Gaza Strip. This has never happened in the entire history of the United Nations that so many people working for the UN have lost their lives. So, I mean, this needs to focus minds. Happening to journalists, happening to United Nations employees, happening to other aid workers, happening to health workers. Over.
Absolutely, absolutely, Jonathan. So, let me go to the platform now. I see Elaine is waiting.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my question from Health Policy Watch. The U.S. is now formally withdrawn from the World Health Organization, and we noticed the flag is also lowered. The U.S. flag is lowered at the WHO compound. However, the U.S. has also issued a very stinging statement, basically today, basically accusing WHO of everything it lost during the COVID pandemic. I wondered if WHO, if Tariq Online could respond and also tell us if you're going to give back the flag, because that seems to have become a kind of secondary issue in this whole thing.
Ellen, thank you very much. I'll ask for your patience. Tariq is online. I'm sure he will answer your question afterwards, but I want to finish on Gaza, and we have also other briefer waiting. I won't forget your question, but we'll come to it at the end. John Zarokostas, then Efe.
Good morning, and hello, Jonathan and Juliet. Firstly, if you have any comments from the remarks yesterday by the head of the Palestinian Technocratic Committee, Dr. Ali Shaaf, that the Rafah crossing will be opening next week two ways. And secondly, concerning UNRWA, can you operate without restrictions in Gaza on the health domain, or do you have severe restrictions? Thank you.
Jonathan.
I'm sorry, I was struggling to unmute now. Thanks for the question, John. Regarding Rafah, I mean, it's important that all crossings be open, that aid flows in at scale by all means possible. That's all I have to say. But clearly, you know, the on-off situation with Rafah, as with the other crossings, has been incredibly problematic. I mean, these are policy choices to not allow crossings to operate at scale on a regular basis, and everything needs to be open. You know, the gates have to be fully open so that aid can come in as required into the Gaza Strip. I mean, aid is not flowing in at the scale required. Then regarding your question on how we're able to operate, I mean, we remain in a very, very significant healthcare provider in the Gaza Strip, primary healthcare. We have something the order of 15,000 patients a day coming to our clinics. But of course, you know, the majority of our clinics are not able to operate. We had 22 clinics operating across the Gaza Strip before the start of the war. We're now down to half a dozen. We have mobile health teams that operate, but in incredibly complicated circumstances. A number of our facilities lie behind the so-called yellow line or in close proximity to it. So that makes it incredibly difficult to do our work. And so many of our locations have been heavily damaged or indeed completely destroyed. On top of that, we remain banned by the Israeli authorities from bringing in any of our own supplies. This has been a ban that was imposed at the beginning of March 2025. That has not been lifted for us. This means that we've faced regular stockouts of you know, basics, basic medical material and medicines in our pharmacies. We continue to manage to work, but you know, we have one hand tied behind our back, and we should be able to do our job to the full. And that's essential, given our role, and also given that the mandate is, and I've stressed this already, but you know, we have a mission which is given to us by the United Nations General Assembly, so by the international community, and we should be able to do it fully. That's all I have on that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Effie.
Thank you. My question is for Jonathan, because regarding the Israeli storming of the UNRWA's compound, you mentioned that you needed more condemnation, but especially more action. So I was wondering from who you expect more action, and which specific actions you expect. Thank you.
I mean, member states of the United Nations have many different tools in their box to bring about changes in approach by other countries. It's not for me to say which tools they should take out of the box and use, but there are many different means. Words do matter, but actions are equally important. Now, the UN Secretary General, of course, has talked about a possible referral to the International Court of Justice. The International Court of Justice has been crystal clear over and over that we need to be able to do our work. That is one important track. But you know, there are other tracks. We've seen a total breach of the Convention on Privileges and Immunities of the United Nations, and that's, you know, in the same way that countries' embassies and consulates are supposed to be protected, United Nations facilities are also supposed to be protected. So there are other tracks on that front. You know, referral to the United Nations General Assembly. All of these kind of things, but regarding what countries could do at their level, countries or groups of countries, that's really for them to decide and to say.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. Last question from Moussa, and then we'll go to Mozambique.
Merci beaucoup. J'ai commencé à vous écouter un peu tard. Je ne sais pas si vous avez parlé de la situation générale humanitaire à Gaza. Oui. Mais ma question concerne ce que M. Trump et son gendre Jared Kushner ont annoncé hier à Davos, que les aides humanitaires arrivent à Gaza d'une façon plus que les besoins, et il n'y a plus de malnutrition à Gaza. Je voudrais savoir si jusqu'à quel point ces propos sont justes. Merci.
Je pense, Moussa, que Juliette et Jonathan ont parlé de ça, mais peut-être qu'ils veulent réitérer ce qu'ils ont dit là-dessus.
Bien sûr, merci. Je répondrai en français. Donc, oui, merci pour la question. Je ne répondrai pas aux propos des politiques ou d'autres directement, mais ce que je peux dire, c'est que la situation à Gaza, ça reste une catastrophe humanitaire. Nous étions dans une situation de famine déclarée l'été dernier. Les impacts physiques de ce genre de situation perdurent. Donc, on ne peut pas dire qu'il n'y a plus de malnutrition. Bien sûr, la situation a changé dans le sens qu'il y a de l'aide humanitaire qui entre. Mais ce n'est pas assez. Et ce n'est pas comme si une situation s'arrête immédiatement. Il y a des impacts sur la population qui continuent. Donc, c'est pour ça que l'opération humanitaire doit pouvoir augmenter d'une façon massive. Et que la population doit être épaulée pendant très, très longtemps, parce que les impacts, ça risque de perdurer, sinon. Merci.
Thank you very much. I'd like to thank Jonathan and Juliette for this briefing, and also Juliette for coming back in her new position. And obviously, Juliette, we will be very happy to see you also in person in March. Thanks to both. Continue updating us on, as Jonathan said, this disastrous situation, and thanks again. So let me go to the second topic of this briefing, which is the situation in Mozambique. To talk to brief us about this, we have IOM and IFRC. Start maybe with IOM. Omundi has brought us Andrew Peter Obat, who is the head of IOM's sub-office in Pemba, in Mozambique. Maybe you want to introduce your colleague, and then we'll hear from him, and then we will go to IFRC.
Yeah, thank you very much. As you're already aware, weeks of torrential raining in Mozambique has led to intense flooding in the country, flooding that has had an immense impact, especially on populations in both Gaza province and in Maputo. So far, based on our data, we are looking at figures of almost approximately 600,000 people who have been affected so far. Our teams are on the ground and they're responding. And today we are gladly joined with our head of office from our head of office in the country, in the sub office on Pemba. And he's going to be briefing today, giving us a bit of an insight on what actually the situation is like in the province of Gaza, the one that's mostly affected by the flooding.
Gaza, Mozambique. Let's be clear, because you'll be speaking about Gaza. So I give the floor to Andrew now.
Thank you so much, Alexandra, and thanks, Kennedy. And I'm happy that you have managed to clarify that it is Gaza, Mozambique, not Gaza, that we have been discussing since we started our discussion. Now, if you don't mind, allow me to switch off my camera. The internet over here is not good. Power off and on, so that we can proceed without
Andrew,
camera. That can
Andrew,
be very clear.
Andrew, sorry. Yeah. This briefing is also for visual journalists. So if you could keep your camera on, we can hear you loud and clear, and we can see you loud and clear. Not loud, but well and clear. Okay. So if you could, if we have problems with the voice, I'll tell you. But for the moment, it's going well, and we need the images too. Sorry. Thank you.
Okay. No, that's okay. So thanks, Alexandra. So today I would want to share what families across Mozambique, especially here in Gaza province, where I'm currently deployed, are going through based on the weeks of heavy rainfall that has triggered or widespread flooding, especially in the central and the southern Mozambique, forcing many families to flee and seek refuge in different locations. As Ken has already mentioned, there are over 600,000 population or people that have been affected. And this is the data that has come from IOM in collaboration with the National Institute for Disaster Management and Risk Reduction, which is the government wing that validates the data that we produce. Now, Gaza is the hardest hit, as you might have seen, among all the provinces that have been affected in central and the southern region. And the populations that are displaced and communities are really facing acute shortage of shelter, essential household items, accommodation centers are becoming increasingly overwhelmed, and many families lack access to water, sanitation, hygiene services, which may increase the risk of waterborne diseases. Now, I also have to mention that at the moment there are different accommodation centers across the province, and apparently we have up to 71 accommodation centers, and some accommodation centers are having really overcrowded with over 51,000 people within those accommodation centers. Now, the risk of families also waterborne diseases, as I've just mentioned, the food supply, the basic services are under severe constraint. You know that we have seen, you might have seen that the infrastructures, most of the roads have been affected. There's no access from, for example, from Maputo to Gaza, and therefore bringing even supplies to these places are becoming a great challenge. The health services and protections support remain limited, and even the displaced crowd have risk of protection issues, which different agencies, including IOM, are trying to address. Now, the government of Mozambique declared a nation wide red alert that was on the 16th of January and has been appealing for international support, including air assets, search and rescue, logistic and technical assistance, which IOM, including other humanitarian agencies, are currently providing. Now, IOM is tracking the displacement and priority needs through the DTM, providing regular updates at the moment and integrating that support and looking into how the agencies and responders, both the government wing and the humanitarian wing, are able to provide a well-coordinated response and the information that is being collected also to help in planning and mainly targeted response at national and provincial level. Now, IOM has deployed quite a number of staffs at the moment for different units, that is in the WASH sector, in the shelter sector, protection, camp management and camp coordination to support in the accommodation centers, the protection, the prevention of sexual exploitation and abuse. We also have colleagues in coordination and also in health, including mental health and psychosocial support. And this has been done through the support from different sub-offices, especially the Pemba sub-office, but also colleagues that are in country at the national level in Maputo. Now, IOM is also supporting evacuation, delivering shelter and essential household kits, which will be distributed. Apparently, we have up to 7,000 kits, the non-food item kits that will be transported from Pemba to Sofala and also to Gaza. Apparently, the road from Pemba to Gaza is accessible, but not from Maputo. In addition, we are channeling some grants as well, short-term sub-grant to vetted Mozambican organizations, enabling them to reach communities in hard to reach areas. And this modality, we are using it because it's faster to identify the national organizations that are already in the country, that already knows the area very well, and IOM will be providing these sub-grants through rapid response funds. Now, the humanitarian needs are now outspacing available resources, and everyone is overstretched. This region, the central and the southern region, were marked for drought, and a number of districts were affected by drought, 5 districts. And now there are new districts that we thought probably will not be, you know, affected by anything. Now those are the districts that we have floods, and the humanitarians are really overstretched. We urgently need support to scale up the response. This includes reinforcing site management in overcrowded accommodation centers and expanding the distribution of emergency shelter and essential household items. There's also need to strengthen water, sanitation, and hygiene services, as I mentioned earlier, where access allows, the deployment of the mobile health team will also be something that we are looking into. Today, we are deploying a health specialist who will be arriving this afternoon to look into that. The protection team are coming this afternoon as well, the mental health and psychosocial support. And we also would want to make sure that sustaining displacement tracking matrix to provide data, it continues, and so that we make sure that we provide the real-time information for prioritization for other partners, but also to provide an informed decisions when they are the partners are making decisions, both the government and also the humanitarian. Now, given the scale of the needs and growing pressure on essential services, IOM will be appealing for up to $20 million US dollars. And this funding will allow us to reinforce life-saving assistance immediately while helping flood-affected families begin to rebuild their homes, restore basic services, and regain stability. And you know, from the weather projections, we are hoping that towards end of next week, the waters will start coming down and there will be more access. And this period of time is where we are trying to really mobilize all the capacities that we have, be it human resource supplies, and to make sure that once there's a better access, then we can reach more populations that are not being reached at the moment. This is rapidly, the situation, as I said, is rapidly evolving, and the response will require really an urgent action to save lives alongside a sustained support to help families recover, rebuild, and restore essential services. IOM remains fully committed to support the government of Mozambique and work alongside our partners to protect life, preserve dignity, and meet the urgent and growing needs of the communities at the moment. Thank you so much, Alexandra and colleagues. I'll
thank
stop
you.
There for
mm-hmm.
now. And
thank
if
you
there's
very much.
Any question, then you can come in.
Thank you. Thank you. Let me now turn to Scott, to my right. Scott, you've brought John Roche, who is your head of delegation for Mozambique and Angola. I can see him on the line. You want to start, or we go to
no,
John?
We can just
yeah?
go straight to John?
Let's go straight to John. John, welcome. Welcome to the briefing in Geneva. You have the floor.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and good morning. And to compliment Dr. Andrew, I'm speaking to you at the moment of a really growing concern for communities across Mozambique. This widespread flooding across the country is now impacting and affecting 10 out of Mozambique's 11 provinces. We're talking of nearly over 500,000 people that have been impacted, for up to about 400,000 people displaced, and thousands of lost homes, livelihoods. And again, don't quote me the figures, because as Dr. Andrew also pointed out, there are areas that are just inaccessible at the moment, and the real picture will only be determined over the coming days as the situation unfolds. Behind these figures, there are families who have lost everything in matters of hours, homes washed away, crops submerged just weeks before harvest, and roads cut off, isolating entire communities. For many people, this flooding comes on top of years of repeated shocks, cyclones, droughts, and now prolonged rains, limiting the ability to cope and recover. This is just the beginning of the disaster season. We haven't even entered the cyclone season, and yet the scale of this is unprecedented, that in the beginning of this disaster season that so many areas have been impacted in a very short space of time. For many people, this flooding comes, as I said, on 16th of January, the government of Mozambique declared a nationwide red alert, enabling a scale-up of emergency response efforts. This was a critical step. However, with the rainy season continuing and several dams already at near capacity, there is a very real risk that the situation could even worsen if these dams overflow. From the onset of this emergency, Mozambique Red Cross Society has been supported by us, the IFRC, and have been working together with the government authorities to support the response. Local Red Cross volunteers, many of them affected themselves and their families impacted, their homes also washed away, have been on the forefront of the early warning dissemination, evacuations, first aid, and initial relief assistance, and now also assisting in these shelters where people are displaced or being hosted. The local presence matters. It means early warnings reach people before the waters rise. It means evacuations happen faster, and it means the trust, which is essential in an emergency, is already there. The Mozambique Red Cross has reached over 400,000 people with early warning messages and continues to support evacuations in Zambezi, Gaza, and Maputo, alongside anticipatory action activities activated in Zambezi and ongoing early action in Sofia. On the ground, trained volunteers are providing first aid, basic health services, evacuation, and the distribution of pre-positioned household and hygiene items across 7 provinces and Maputo City, with further mobilization depending on available resources. Access, of course, as Dr. Andrew stated, remains one of the biggest challenges. Flooded roads and damaged infrastructures are making it difficult to reach some of the most isolated communities, and this picture is yet not, we don't have the full picture of the damage yet. We are also increasingly concerned about public health risks, including waterborne diseases. People are forced to rely on contaminated water sources and overcrowded temporary shelters. Moving forward, priorities include shelter, access to safe water and sanitation, health services, and support for livelihoods, particularly for those who have lost their crops and income sources. Looking beyond the immediate response, the crisis once again highlights a deeper reality. Early warnings and preparedness save lives and are critical investments. Communities need support to better anticipate, withstand, and recover from these shocks. That means sustained investment in early warning systems, climate resilient infrastructure, and locally led preparedness is of utmost importance. In closing, the situation in Mozambique is serious and evolving. The coming days will be critical. Continued international attention, solidarity. We see this is amazing because so much is impacted. We're seeing it across the Mozambique Red Cross going and working in these centers. Other communities are coming to support. They are bringing whatever food they have from their houses. They are bringing blankets to house those poor unfortunates who are displaced from their own homes. So we see a real solidarity among communities in this very difficult, which is impacting so many people and so many lives. So we want to help communities not only survive the crisis, but to recover with dignity and be better prepared. Thank you, and I'm happy to...
No, thank you. Thank you very much, John, and thanks, Andrew, for your briefings. John, the audio wasn't perfect, but I understand that Scott and colleagues are going to send your note to the journalist as soon as possible, and I think Andrew's ones have already been distributed. So I'll open the floor to questions. Now, EFE, the Spanish news agency.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to ask, I don't know if you mentioned this, but I wonder if due to the floodings, the displaced people from the violence in the north provinces are going back to these unsafe regions. Thank you.
We would like to take this. John, I see your camera is on.
Obviously, at the moment, it's difficult to move because of the many places around the water. So this is I can't really give you a real answer on this today. Maybe IOM has a better picture, but as I said, we're tracking more people, moving them to safer areas. So it's not about returning at the moment. That's not the focus of this response operation.
Andrew, you want to add something?
Yeah, just to complement what Jonah said, clearly at the moment we don't have a clear data on that people that are being displaced from floods are going back to conflict-affected areas. Majority of the populations that are being displaced are mainly in the evacuation centers, and some are in the host community living on the highland area. So far that is the information that we have. And also, I think the geographical location between the central and the north is quite far. Access has been an issue, so that has not been significantly mentioned or recorded somewhere.
Thank you. Nina Larsson.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I was just I may have missed it, but I didn't hear a death toll so far from the floods. Do you have any estimate of that, and how do you see that evolving going forward? What are your estimates going forward? Thank you.
Who would like to answer this? Maybe John, do you have any answer, or Andrew?
Yeah, I mean, we're painting the pictures. That's why there are many. At the moment, we're talking in between 50 and 60 deaths, and this is going to increase as we get access. You know, as I said, as the floodwaters start to recede, we will get into more communities, and then these reports will come back. So again, the numbers already that have been recorded, but they're not accurate because, as I said, we're still trying to get access to really cut off areas that we can't pass because of the flowing waters.
Andrew?
Yeah, thank you. Nothing much to add from what Jonas said, but by next week, as we get more access, especially to severely affected areas, we will be able to have more information on that.
Thank you. Keep us informed. Is there any other question for our colleagues on Mozambique? I don't see any. So I'd like to thank both Kennedy and Scott for bringing their colleagues to us. And thanks very much to Andrew and John for briefing the journalists here. Keep us informed, especially, as you said, once you'll have more access to these areas. Thank you to all. So I haven't forgotten Elian's question. I'd like to ask Tariq to come in and, if possible, answer Elian's former question.
Can you hear me, Alessandra?
We can.
So just before that, just to answer, Olivia had a question for me, and Olivia, I sent you something, but we don't have anything specific on opening on RAPA, but as we heard from colleagues, more access, better it is. We need to bring in more supplies. What we have now is there are clearance procedures that cause delay for certain medical equipment, like lab equipment and what is being considered as a dual use. So we need more crossings, not only for supplies, but also for medical evacuations. When it comes to medical evacuations, we really call particularly on opening the route to West Bank, including East Jerusalem, because that's the most efficient route. We hope that we will have someone from Gaza on Tuesday to brief you with more details. On question on the US withdrawal, this matter is now on the agenda of the upcoming executive board that starts on first week of February, and we as secretariat we will act on advice and guidance of our governing bodies accordingly. There is a document that is posted on an executive board website that's provisional agenda item 22.9, and the document is EB 158/45, and it's called collaboration within the United Nations system and with other intergovernmental organizations. So this is the secretariat input into this debate. You have heard from our principal legal officer and DG on this topic 10 days ago, so no need for me to repeat that. But again, the main thing is that this matter will be discussed. It's with member states now, and it will be discussed at the executive board meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Tariq. John?
Good morning, Tariq. It's a follow-up to Elaine's question. Is there a comment from the Director General's office on the press statement dated 22 January by the US government, the State Department and HHS, concerning what they're saying about the WHO secretariat? They're very strong comments. Is there any formal response from the Director General's office to all the elements outlined, allegations against the secretariat? Thank you.
And maybe Tariq, just also Elaine has been putting in the chat, she had also asked about the flag.
Flag is a part of that discussion that we will ask the guidance from the executive board and from member states. So this is really for member states to discuss. Regarding all these issues that have been raised in executive order a year ago, we have been really answering that in detail over the years, so really there is no need for me to go through point by point. Again, just look for the couple of previous Dr. Tedros press briefings where this has been discussed.
Thank you. Any other question to WHO? I don't see any. Thank you very much, Tariq, for coming in. So that concludes our briefing of today. Really, I just wanted to remind you that today the Committee on the Rights of the Child terminates its work. They still have next week, but they terminate the number of countries that they are reviewing. And then they will have a meeting with the member states in the afternoon of the 29th of January. We've spoken about the Council. You know that there is this special session this afternoon, starting at 2 p.m. It will address the deteriorating human rights situation in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And of course, Pascal and his team are available to answer your question. If anybody have sent out also in your mail, you find a lot of information from them yesterday and the day before. So if there are no other questions for me, I wish you a very good weekend, and thank you very much for participating. Thanks.